one song per questions and interaction, but it's more or less an hour and a half.
Because I'm wondering just about the time. If we have to be somewhere at 7, we should leave at 6:30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's 4 something.
Let's try to do it like... I try to have the presentation in an hour, maybe an hour and a half, some questions, and then go into the more logistical things.
Yeah,
I think we have to see a few
things. An hour, process. Not an hour and a half, I think is better.
Okay, we'll try. We'll speed it up.
Yeah. Are you going to tell us something about Seed Pod?
Yeah, of course, we're going to tell about our work and those kind of things, but it might be nice beforehand, like,
yeah.
A little bit that you talk about yourself as well. Well, I will start with myself. My name is Jet. I'm from Holland. I'm here in CPAS right now, 5.5 years working here. And yeah, it's me.
You're
going to see me a lot around in the next following days, so you will get to know me a bit better.
Your background? What you
My background, okay. I'm Dutch. I studied human geography with a master in political geography in Amsterdam and the University of Lund, Sweden. And after that, I worked for about 3 years in the communication department of the City Hall of Amsterdam. And then I decided it was time for a drastical change in my life, and I came here. The idea was for a year, but right now it is 5.5 years, and probably I'm going to stay a little longer.
My name is Tanya, and I'm from Sweden, and I'm a human rights lawyer, and I've been with CPAS for a little bit more than a year. And before that, I was working with a Swedish organization in Guatemala and in Chiapas as an accompanier and also as a campanista?
Human rights observer.
Observer in Chiapas. And I'm going to stay for a year.
My name is John. I come from the Basque Country in Spain. I got a degree in law. And I've been living in Chiapas for 2 years. 1 year working for CPAS, and I'm going to specialize in human rights.
And there are two people missing. Marina is the coordinator, and I think she just went to see the computer, check the mail. And there is Roberto from Italy as well, who's missing.
So what about Heike?
Heike is in Germany. Yeah. And we don't really know when she's going to come back. We assume she will come back at some point, but
Yeah. So right now she got like more or less a steady job in Germany, and she's doing their peace education work as well.
Oh, good.
But tomorrow, where is she from?
Sorry? Marina?
France.
So,
okay.
So do we move to us?
Yeah, please.
So okay. I'm Carolina, and I have started coming to Chiapas. I came at first to the school for Chiapas and Pastor Peace the same summer in 1997.
Wow.
And I've been coming back to be supporting ever since. And I lived here for a year from 2001 to 2002 and worked within an autonomous community teaching women literacy. Amazing experience. And so, yeah.
Wow.
And I'm part of MITF, which is the organization that's I'm on the board, and we've done, this is the third.
Is this our third delegation or fourth?
Third.
Third. Yeah, I think it is the third.
Fourth.
Four is the fourth?
It's the fourth. Yep, remember 2002?
I was on the second.
It was the first. Yeah.
I'm Betsy, and I'm a retired teacher, and I live in San Miguel de Allende.
My name is Karen, and this is my first time in Mexico. About 24 hours, in a little bit. And I live in Madison, Wisconsin, so I'm near Chicago. I work mostly as a Spanish interpreter, and I work in hospitals and clinics. And I learned my Spanish while I live in Peace Corps and the Dominican Republic.
My name is Gwen, and I live in California, originally from South Africa, and I came with MITF mainly to take photographs and images document what we were seeing photographically and to learn.
Okay, big Mexican caravan that came. And I think most of the time I probably come with Pastors for Peace, I would say, in a way over the years. So I'm happy to be here now, and sort of I haven't really been quite as involved the last year or two, although MITF has supported various projects. We've given money to the School of Urban Tea ever since 1997. But I'm very interested in sort of what's going on now, and I have some trepidations about what's going on not only here but all over Mexico. This feels very tenuous to me.
And I want to know that some of us just took a bus from Oaxaca this morning. I mean, we took it last night again this morning. And seven of us were actually in Oaxaca for a whole week.
Wow, okay. So you know more what happened than we do, probably.
My name is Mark, and this is my fourth or fifth time here in Chiapas.
Okay, that's all?
Oh, you're finished? Oh, I thought you were interrupted. I'm Carol, and this is my second delegation with MITF, and Carolyn and Dale, and Colleen, to Chiapas. And I was also in Oaxaca.
My name is Walter. I work with a little group in Davis near Sacramento that called Big Davis Religious Community, the sanctuary that raises money for projects in Guatemala and El Salvador and Haiti. And I've been in Guatemala several times, but I've never been in southern Mexico. So I went to the Oaxaca trip and now to this trip. I'm going to Guatemala at the end of the week.
I'm Colleen, and I'm with MITF also. I'm the events coordinator. And this is my third trip to Chiapas.
And I'm Colleen number two. And this is my first trip with the group. My interest is that I've been here before, I've been to Chiapas before, but living in San Miguel, as I do for half the year, I very much follow what's happening in Mexico, and I'm very concerned as well. I'm concerned what's happening in the United States. I'm very concerned. But and of course I go to the global justice meetings in San Miguel, and I really get the feeling, I mean, you get the feeling what's happening and things are happening, and it's, so I was just wanting to find out more. So that's why I came.
Well, very welcome to Chiapas and Chiapas.
I don't think you all need to stand for 2 hours. There's chairs.
Oh my God! Sorry. What? If you want.
Do you want to
No, I think we'll just dance around here because we'll have a map.
Whoa! Is it okay?
Yeah. Yes,
right.
It'll be okay.
It's
a
dangerous place.
Okay, so this is a. This is a PowerPoint presentation about the history of Chiapas from 1994 and onwards. And we call it the peace process, war process.
I don't know if you already know the map of Chiapas. Mm-hmm. This is where San Cristobal is. The capital city, Tuxtla, is somewhere around here. And in this map, we can see the areas where there are more indigenous peoples living and where the level of marginality is higher. Marginality takes in account things like income, employment, housing, things like that. So we can see that the areas where there are more indigenous peoples living, like the areas in blue and purple, are the same areas where the marginality is higher, and the marginality is with these stripes. So here we have the La Cantona jungle, here is the highlands, and here is the northern zone. This is the area that we visit more often.
Sorry, what is the stripes mean?
Marginality level.
Marginality.
It's very high marginality level areas. So in the next map we see that the areas where there are indigenous peoples living and where the marginality level is higher is also the area of the conflict. Again, we see the highlands, northern sun, and the Lacandona jungle. So we see the link between these three things, like poverty, indigenous peoples, and the conflict.
Now we'll take you briefly to Chiapas before 94. Do you want us to turn up the light, or is it okay like this?
It seems fine.
Yeah. Should we maybe move it a little bit more? Okay, so here are like some bullet points on Chiapas before 94. It's a very rich state, but the tricky part is that it has great inequalities. And that's the paradox, that it's the poorest state in Mexico. The population is the poorest population, but it's one of the richest states
in resources.
Yeah. And, for example, 34% of its inhabitants did not have access to electricity. That was before 94, but little has changed since then. And also, the funny thing about Chiapas is that, as you can see, there are, like, there's lots of water here, and we have some, we have really lots of rivers from the northern zone, Great Lakes down here, and so Chiapas produces 30% of all the hydroelectric energy in Mexico, but still its inhabitants do not have access to electricity in all the communities. And also another data is that 60% of all school-age children were unable to attend school before 94, and the literacy level is 30%. But once again, little has changed to date. And also we have to have in mind here when we watch these numbers that these are like overall figures. But if you go to the indigenous population, they will be even higher.
The subpoenas, it seems to be getting lower. I mean, around attending school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted to tell you that this presentation is based on a document, a peace process, which is available on our website. So mm-hmm. you can take notes, but you can find this thing mm-hmm. later. Yeah. And if you are interested in the PowerPoint presentation, you can have it sent to your email.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Some other things that happened before 94 is that, in 1983, on 17th of November 1983, the ECLN, the Zapatista Army for National Liberation, was founded in the jungle. And it was like a mixture between academics from Mexico City coming down to the jungle to teach the indigenous population about revolution, about Marxist revolution. What they encountered in the jungle
you
was...
Out there.
This is our fifth member. Very wet. What actually happened is that they entered the jungle and they found like already people being organized, already having a plan for the future, already contemplating revolution, but more slowly, not as fast, and not with Marxist perception as such. So there was a mixture between these two processes, and this was also amplified by the Catholic Church and its work in Chiapas, educating people in the villages and giving them certain positions in the church, in the autonomous church.
It's very interesting to see how all these revolutionary intellectuals came to Chiapas to teach the indigenous peoples, and then they realized they could also learn from them.
Some other things that happened before 94, which are like important to have in mind, is that the coffee price dropped in 1989, and people here often sell coffee to be able to buy things that they can't produce. So like coffee is a luxury product, which then they can buy soap, oil, sugar, salt, anything they can produce.
So before there was a fixed price for the coffee, but when they was liberalized it.
And also, Article 27 of the Constitution was changed, which made it possible to privatize communal lands, because the indigenous population, after the revolution in the 19th century, all land, some lands were made communal, like for people, for indigenous population. And now they started to privatize this land, which also weakened peoples in Chiapas.
What year was it?
It was the 20th century.
Yeah.
Sorry, 20th
century. What year was Article 27 changed?
Sorry, it was in 92.
92?
92. Also, what else did I want to tell you? Yeah. Also, in 94, Mexico, before 94, started to prepare itself to enter into NAFTA, the North American Free Trade. And this coincides with the uprise on the 1st of January, 1994, when the UCLN declared war on the Mexican government. And it took over four county seats in Chiapas, San Cristóbal de las Casas, Ocosingo, Altamirano, and Las Margaritas. And in the first declaration of the Lacandona Jungle, they demanded work, land, housing, food, health, education, independence, liberty, democracy, justice, and peace. And these are demands that echo any constitution in the world, more or less, and various international and national declarations and conventions. So this is nothing new. They wanted things that were very reasonable.
And also before 94, there were so many demonstrations here.
Oh yeah.
They followed many other means of trying to get these demands met before
sure.
they ever had to
sure, sure. Well, this led to 12 days of war, and this is the only time until now that the Zapatistas actually have taken used arms, yeah. And it led to between 145 and 1,000 deaths. This is according to government information, and this is according to the Zapatista information. Mm-hmm. And we still don't know how many people were killed. So during 94, there were lots of manifestations. The civil society was really doing a great job here in Chiapas, but also internationally. And eventually it led to a ceasefire, and the first dialogues began in the cathedral here in San Cristóbal. And the government also freed some prisoners, and New Zealand released its only hostage.
The hostage was a former general that had been also the governor of Chiapas.
What was your name?
I don't remember.
That's not funny enough for which I'm sure she will know. Okay, so in July, they've been doing dialogues for a couple of months, and the UCLN always tries to have like a very democratic procedure. So it asks its grassroots members if they want what they think about the government proposals. And the bases reject the proposal, and they say that they did not respond to its demands. And in their turn, the federal government refuses to undertake any further negotiations with the UCLN.
It's a process that will repeat itself a lot of times, because it's very, very often the Zapatistas and the government start a dialogue, but then something happens and
Eventually they started again a month later, and it was, you probably know who this is. It's from Samuel Ruiz, who was
presiding the CONAI, which is the National Commission on Indigenous Affairs, and he was mediating the dialogues between the government and the UCLN. And the negotiations took place in San Andres, and I don't know if you know, yeah, you probably know, the ones of you who visited Chiapas before, it's really close here to San Cristobal. And they elaborated four themes for, you know, like four rounds. The first round was, the first theme was on indigenous rights and culture, then democracy and justice, welfare and development, and women's rights. The indigenous rights and culture is the only topic that eventually led to a document, which then led to the San Andres Accords. The other ones failed. I'm taking this a little bit faster because we don't have lots of time. So, but if you have any questions, just go ahead. So at the end of 95, okay, let's first take the San Andres Accords. So, yeah, they're signed by both parties, which is like really important. The government signs these the results of this round. So, sorry?
Dialogue.
And afterwards, in September, the UCLN decides to leave the negotiations because the government sends delegates that don't say anything. They just sit there and they keep quiet and they don't like have anything to offer or to discuss. So the UCLN feels that this is like this is a farce. This is a sham, and they decide to leave. They also have like certain conditions. They say that they want further prisoners to be freed, liberated, and they also want the government to send a delegation which has more power to these negotiations. So the San Andres Accords are elaborated into a law proposal that the government then changes, and it's substantially changed. So it has nothing to do with the original agreement and what both parties signed, and the UCLN feels very betrayed. So as a reaction to this, they organize a protest, a march, which is called the March of 1111, and they march on Mexico City. Also, this is not very true because the conflict already turns into a low-intensity warfare in 95, at the end of 95, and during 96 it continues, but in 97 it reaches its peak, and it has a religious character in many parts of Chiapas.
Religious character, how?
For instance, in 97, I think we'll have that as a point afterwards, in Actal, on the 22nd of December, 45 people are killed in Actal, and there are certain religious points there, because the ones who are killed are Catholics. The members of a paramilitary group are not entirely evangelical or Protestants, but they later on turn into Presbyterians. And in the northern zone, where CIPAS is working more than anything, you have a rather clear-cut division between the Zapatistas, who are Catholics, and a paramilitary group called Peace and Justice, which is entirely Protestant or evangelical, as they call it here. And this is part of a governmental strategy as well, to divide and conquer the villages. and make like have a yeah to make them feel very very different, to feel that there is an abyss between one part of the population and the other one. So at the one hand, the government is like doing negotiations, trying to discuss with the Zapatistas. The military presence in Chiapas is to do social work and things like that. But on the other hand, they have a counterinsurgency strategy, which is also seen as a low-intensity warfare. And some of the characteristics of this strategy is to manipulate public opinion and to spread rumors, which is very efficient, and it still exists in a lot of villages in Chiapas. And this was also very very used in Guatemala, for instance, in the 80s. And well, the strategy, I forgot to tell you, the strategy is called to take away the water from the fish. And this is a strategy that was used by the US in Vietnam and afterwards in Guatemala, where you're trying to, where the fish is, you see the Zapatistas, for instance, as the fish, and the water is symbolized by the communities, by the villages that are helping or aiding the guerrilla. So if you attack the villages, if you take away the fish, then you will be able to kill the fish.
But the Zapatistas are the water.
No, they're the fish. You take away the water, the fish die.
Who said that? We learned that early in this trip. There's a quote.
Yeah?
Oh, I think it was Gustavo Esteban.
Take the water.
Yeah, right, the Zapatistas are
would
the water.
The support basis would be the water.
Right.
Yeah. Right, but the Zapatistas are also the water because the Zapatistas are mostly
are
support bases.
Sure.
They don't
you
have
can see
the
gorilla.
That's
the
fish.
There's
the fish.
There's the fish.
Yeah, the fish are the Zapatistas.
The army.
The army, the militia, the gorilla, the armed part.
Yeah, the fish?
Of the,
the armed part of the Zapatistas.
Or the gorilla in Guatemala, or the Viet Cong in Vietnam. Other ways of subtly making war against the Zapatistas was to terrorize the civil population and also make selective exemplary actions in hope to prevent the insurgency to spread to other parts of the society. So they attacked maybe teachers, or they put Zapatista leaders in prison. And that way they spread fear in the whole society. Okay, so this is what I already mentioned, that this led to like a spiral of violence as well, which then continued into 1998. And it reached its peak in December with the massacre at Actel, which had like Guatemalan proportions, and the Mexican state was just not prepared to face this fact. And this is also like them seeing how the paramilitary actions just escalated, and they did not have control over the situation any longer. So, the counterinsurgency or the low-intensity warfare started in the northern zone. I can show you on the map later on, around Tila more than anything. And then it spread to the highlands and to the jungle. And the peak was reached in the northern zone with 4,000 IDPs, displaced persons, and 10,000 in the highlands. And there are still some villages, some communities that haven't been able to come back to their villages.
So people of the Abejas just went back?
They were not displaced in 1997, it was more
Because I know I walked with some people who went back in 2001.
Yeah.
I think but some people just went back, or they got a new village, the place we're visiting.
Yeah, they got back like in Easter, but they did not go back to their original.
They got a different.
Yeah, they had to buy a new land. But they were not displaced in 97. They were displaced in 99, and they were displaced not because they were abejas. They were they belonged to another organization at that time, and then they contacted the abejas. But yeah, we're going to visit that village.
Is the Antel massacre in
97? 97. Yeah.
December
22nd.
I just did the abejas were not Zapatistas.
They're not Zapatistas.
Yeah.
But they're in resistance.
They were in resistance also.
And they were almost, the paramilitaries almost hated them more in a way,
yeah,
because they believed totally in nonviolence and they refused to support any armed actions against the Zapatistas. And this just infuriated the paramilitaries.
Yeah. The paramilitaries were trying to have them over to their side and to attack the Zapatistas in Agdal, but they just refused. So, in vengeance, they attacked the community of Las Orejas. So Agdal is divided in three villages now. You have Agdal Zapatista, you have Agdal Abejas, and you have Agdal Highlands, which is where the paramilitaries or the members belonging to the PRI party.
Really?
And this is also part of the strategy to divide people, to divide and conquer and
divide them in different parties, different churches, different organizations.
But the church that the Zapatistas are connected with is similar to the part of the church that the Abejas are.
Yes.
It's the Palabra de Dios.
Yeah.
And you know, when I went on December 22nd, the year that I lived here, there were so many people from autonomous Zapatista communities that came to commemorate with them.
Yeah.
About these displaced people, I wanted to remind that being displaced did not only mean leaving their homes. It meant they had all their belongings either stolen or destroyed. So yeah, even if they could get back to their communities, it was very hard to start again from zero.
Such as belongings as their crops.
And also people moving into their houses and them not being able to come back to their
and harvesting their
sure.
Their crop.
Sure. Okay, so in 98, there was a political and military siege in Chiapas. On one hand, we had an increased militarization in Chiapas. There were 70,000 soldiers present here, and that's in all of Central America. You cannot find so many soldiers in one state as here. And that's one third of the Mexican armed forces. And also, there were lots of attacks against Zapatista municipalities, county seats.
Army attacks or paramilitaries?
Army. Yeah. And on the other hand, the ECLN withdrew themselves and they went into silence for several months. Faced with penal, military, and legal offensives.
Yeah, the ACLN being silent is something very special because all the manifestos they published, they have a lot of attention on them. So when suddenly the ACLN is not publishing anything, it means that something is going on.
So we reach 99, and just a regional conflict because the state, the government always tried to, but especially in 1999, tried to chapanequizar the conflict, to make it just a regional conflict. And also they said that actually the conflict is only in four
four counties in Jefferson. It's not even all Jefferson, just a problem between some communities, some villages. And also, they tried to resolve its causes without the ECLN. So they started, they invented lots of economical and social development projects. But they never tried to incorporate ECLN in this. They never issued a dialogue. And that's also part of the counterinsurgency strategy to give people financial aid and try to resolve superficial things without going in depth to the problems, to the issue. And that's where they started to issue development projects.
Yes, these projects are usually seen like gifts from a candidate or something like that. It's not like serious development projects. Gifts usually used for to support one candidate or to support one party.
Yeah, they're usually very linked to the PRI party. And also you can hear it in electoral periods such as now, because we'll have municipal elections in October, and there you will have candidates telling people that if you don't vote for this or that party, you will lose your development money or your project money. We're taking this very fast, I have a feeling, but because, but feel free to ask.
So the year 2000 was a year of hope and change in Mexico. After the PRI being in power for 71 years, finally they lost their elections. Many people consider this period of 70 years like a perfect dictatorship, because even if formally it was a democracy and there were elections held, the PRI always won the elections. So finally we have PAN in power, which is a right-wing conservative party. And Vicente Fox was the president from the year 2000 to 2006. In Chiapas it was the same thing, the PRI was always in power until Pablo Salazar, an independent candidate who was supported by both PAN and PRD, the left-wing party, beat the PRI. So yeah, it was finally supposedly a democracy in Mexico, and Fox said that during his campaign that he was going to solve the conflict in Chiapas in 15 minutes. So even the ECLN recognized it was an opportunity for peace. Yeah, there were some signs of goodwill, like closing military bases, and all the Zapatista prisoners in Chiapas states were free.
We still have two Zapatista prisoners, which are catequistas. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the English word would be. They're like
catechists.
But they're in Tabasco, they're in another state. So they're still in prison.
But they were freed after the demand that went with the Zapatista march, right?
I think lots of them are freed.
At the end of 2000.
But I don't know.
I think it
had
more to do
with it. The Zapatistas placed to the government to restart the dialogue.
Yeah.
Were the three conditions?
Mm-hmm.
It was freeing the Zapatista prisoners.
The disappointment came quite soon, but during this year it was everyone was so happy that finally PRI was out of the government in Mexico and in Chiapas.
And also lots of people from organizations and NGOs here in San Cristobal felt that this was a great opportunity for peace and for advance and development. So they went with the government, but eventually they were disappointed when they left.
So during the year 2001, finally, the House of Deputies was making a constitutional reform to implement the law proposal that came after the San Andreas Agreement. It was already quite changed in the government proposal, but it was being debated in the House of Deputies. As the ECLN saw that things were not going to be respected, they carried out a big march to Mexico City. And finally, a woman from the ECLN, an indigenous woman with her mask on, spoke in the House of Deputies.
Comandante Esther.
but the deputies belonging to PAN, the right-wing party now in power, left the house while she was speaking.
Felipe Calderón,
the president. So finally, the reform restricted the concept of indigenous autonomy approved in the San Andres Agreement. And the ACLN was considered this was a betrayal. And it was especially like painful because the three main parties supported this reform. Probably they didn't expect much from PRI and PAN, the right-wing party and PRI. But they had not so bad relations with PRD, the left-wing party. And they also supported this reform.
Because lots of Zapatistas, for example, in the Northern Zone were linked to the PRD party. So there was the Zapatistas did not have that many problems or issues with the PRD party as such in Chiapas before. But after 2001, they just knew where they had them. And also, in 98, also, I mean, the Zapatistas already knew that the San Andres Accords would not lead to, the initial San Andres Accords would not lead to any constitutional reform. And also in 98 and 99, the PRI and PAN already had like alternative law proposals. And the San Andres Accords have always been like a toy between all the three parties, and they were manipulating and playing with it however they wanted.
So 1 year after saying that he would solve the conflict in 15 minutes, he said that the conflict was over. And as a protest for this betrayal and this affirmation that the conflict was over, the ACLN kept a long silence again. But this silence didn't mean they weren't working. They were building their own process of autonomy. So even if Fox in a federal level and Salazar in a state level were not so hard against the Zapatistas as the PRI had been, there was also a lot of tension and there was violence too, especially in local levels, in communities. Because the ACLN already decided not to have anything to do with the government, so they started to boycott and not accept any project from the government. This brought a lot of tension with the people living in the communities, supporting these projects, and
there were
some tensions during 2002. Finally, in 2003, the ACLN broke their silence, and they explained in a very very long manifesto why they considered they were being betrayed by the political parties, and they also made public that they had changed their government structures. They killed the Aguascalientes, the previous structures, and they built the Caracoles and the Juntas de Buen Gobierno.
Do you know a little bit about the Zapatista autonomy, how it works with the Caracoles and the municipalities and the villages?
Do you folks know about that?
I think, yeah.
Yeah?
Okay. Not really. I mean, I know the Caracoles, but is there I just did a little bit about how communities work in Oaxaca. Uh-huh. Is it the same? This process of assembly, is it the same?
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It is similar.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The process of assembly, but this whole structure of the Zapatistas is different. That they created at this time.
What was the old form called? And then
well, there were these Aguascalientes, and they were the centers where people would meet the Zapatistas and go. They were called Aguascalientes because it's named after the place where an agreement took place during the revolution with Emiliano Zapata. And I think that's actually where they formed the whole land reform. It was Article 27. And so, but, you know, it's never been totally clear to me what the change meant. They changed the name to Caracoles because it's a place where people spiral in. And the caracol is where you call a meeting together. You know the caracol that people blow to call a meeting together to communicate? And so the people go there to communicate with the Zapatistas. They go in, and you have to go through the caracoles in order to get into the communities. You need to go ask permission, and they created these councils of good government, which were made up of representatives from every autonomous community in that region. And there's five regions, so there's five caracoles. There were five Aguascalientes also, but they didn't have that same kind of government. The regional government wasn't consolidated like that.
Mm-hmm. Before, NGOs and people from the civil society could go directly to the municipalities and give them any kind of support. But that brought a lot of lack of coordination, because some villages and municipalities are very well known and lots of people go there, but there were some more forgotten. So this way, before you go to a community, you have to ask for permission in the Junta del Gobierno,
so
which is a kind of a stronger regional government.
Okay. And then if you want to give money to the Zapatistas, but there's some community that's always getting donations, and there's some people who really need it more than the Junta del Gobierno would decide really who needs it more, and that's where it will go.
Yeah.
But there's also something about the military having that's the thing I didn't totally understand. The military wing having less influence than the civil wing, which is the Junta del Gobierno. That was part of the creation of the Caracoles.
Yeah. There was a more clear separation between the military and the civil
government.
Yeah. But I don't know yet if you can explain it even more in depth.
Well, what they started was the civil structure. It was like the governmental structure of their of their autonomy. In the 2 years of silence, they were starting to building up and strengthen their autonomous structure. So what you have the communities and their live. I'm not sure if it's going further on in the presentation. Okay. In the communities, you have like Zapatista people, but most of the time, all communities are almost divided right now. So you don't have like a whole Zapatista community and a whole PRD community and a whole PR free community. I think almost all communities are divided, but they have their structure. So if there's a problem in the community, they try to solve it first at their autonomous level of the community. The ones who have like are in charge of one of the things in the community will try to solve it. If they're not able, you go to the county or the municipality where they have an autonomous council, what's like of that region, what belongs to that municipality. And there can be a various number of communities belonging to that. There's an autonomous council. There are different posts or jobs for the representatives. And the third level, the third government level in the autonomous way is the Caracoles. And I think one of the things what they started is, what was new was that they are having these councils of good governments who are there as well to mediate if there's a conflict. And when they started the Caracoles, they said, we're there for Zapatista, no Zapatista, and anti-Zapatista people. And we were kind of, well, we will see if that's going to work. And I think the most important or the most interesting thing is that it's going to work, that a lot of no Zapatista people are going to the councils of good government to solve a problem, which can be quite often between two organizations or about land, because it's a juridical system, what belongs more to the culture, that people speak their language and they don't have to pay to get that case, because the corruption in the official structure is quite big. So if there's a conflict, most of the time you have to pay first before anyone wants to look at your case.
So you said there were three levels. People go to the municipality, I missed it, there were three.
The community, the municipality, and the caracol.
Okay. So that's a third. If it's difficult, you go to the end.
That's the regional level.
Oh,
yeah, so like for example, the community sends representatives to the autonomous council of the municipality. So every community in that municipality is represented. And there's some people who are judges and somebody who's a secretary. People have different, and so the judges are the ones who do these kind of mediations. And then each municipality sends representatives to the Junta del Buen Gobierno, the good government councils, that serve the same function in a way.
And especially the Caracol you will go and visit, Morelia, is very well known for being able to resolve conflicts between Zapatistas and people from other organizations. And there are lots of problems related to land problems in this Caracol. And you will go to Alga Isabel, which Jeff will tell you about later on, which is like one of the municipalities that has lots of problems with other organizations regarding to land questions.
But they also seem to be very strong. The autonomous community seems to be very strong.
The municipal councils that are resolving disputes between different parties, are they composed though entirely of Zapatistas?
Yeah.
But the other parties trust them enough.
These communities have parallel governments.
Yeah.
No, autonomous and
autonomous and state government.
Yes.
Okay. And so what, when they say autonomy, the autonomous community, what does that mean in terms of day-to-day life differences? There's a parallel legal system.
Yes.
Police system.
They have prisons.
They sometimes have jails.
Yeah.
Okay. They don't exactly have police, but you know, the community.
They have authorities that are they don't have to be Zapatistas as such. They may be traditional authorities. That's part of the Zapatista structure as well, to recuperate. Old traditional systems as well. And they have autonomous schools, they have autonomous hospitals.
Nothing from the government.
Mainly they say that they take care of education, health, justice, and production projects, like agriculture.
Okay.
So the municipalities recognize the Caracols, is what you're saying. I mean, the state government recognizes.
No. We're talking about autonomous municipalities.
But in the level of conflict resolution, 1, 2, 3 community municipalities.
There's some that they do respect each other. I mean, for instance, in Olga Isabel, you will have state police that will respect the Zapatista structure, and they will have some coordination between them. So there is some mutual respect between these two systems. But I don't know, I don't think that's the strategy overall.
It depends on the community, how well the different parts get along with each other. Sometimes there's terrible conflict, and sometimes they get along. They seem to be parallel and work together when there's the tequios that we call them in Oaxaca. The different, both the subtis and non-subtis will go fix the road together.
I'd like to talk about that more. I don't want to take up time here, but it's interesting to me that the Caracol can override a municipality decision.
When they say municipality, they're talking about Zapatista. That's
autonomous
government.
They're parallel governments. The elected ones and the autonomous ones.
So the three-level system she's talking about is entirely within the important thing to say is that they say they mandar obedeciendo. How do you translate that?
They rule by obeying.
By obeying.
Oh, yeah.
They lead by obeying.
They're interested in
consensus. About listening too, right? It's
important. That was introduced very much through the other campaign, but it's also very important.
It was not well plugged, so the battery ran.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just back to the thing. Before 1994, you said a lot of academics, revolutionary academics, came to Chiapas. Why did they come here? Did they come there because of a particular situation? Or why there?
I think they were inspired by the situation in Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, Cuba. They wanted to make revolution.
But why Chiapas?
I think Chiapas is the poorest,
so marginalized
because of the
right for revolution.
The one that needed the most,
And I think as well that it was very important the role of the bishop, Don Samuel Loris, who came here and started it. You had in, what was it, 74?
Yeah.
The indigenous encounter here, where there was the whole movement of how do you say that to
said?
Yeah, to be
like
aware
consciousness
of
raising.
Consciousness raising about the indigenous people here in Chile.
Is that the same as this libertarian theology?
Yeah.
Yes.
That he was, yeah.
Was he the leader in Mexico?
No. Well, you cannot say it that way. It was like some a movement within the Catholic Church that was started in the 60s, and there was a lot of people who were taking this option of walking with the poor.
Right.
And as Don Samuel said one time in the beginning, like he thought, well, if you give the people some pair of shoes and some things that will go on, they will get a better life. But being here, he realized that there has to be some more structural changes. So he started to organize a lot of the indigenous people in several ways. And that way you can see as well that the Zapatista movement can be like a fruit of the whole process of being aware of who you are and the whole situation there in Chiapas that developed from the 70s on.
They were saying that to us about Oaxaca, the creation of Oaxaca.
In the 1980s, there were a lot of refugees from Guatemala.
Yes.
Also, and also the guerrilla in Guatemala went back and forth across
yeah.
the border.
And
so there must have been a lot of cross-filtering of ideas, I would think.
I would think so, too. And there are lots of mass graves still in Chiapas, which are still...
Because the Guatemalan army would cross
yes,
the border sometimes,
they would cross.
Too.
And also
unofficially, yeah.
And also Guatemalan refugees would come into Mexican territory famished,
mm-hmm.
like... And they would just die, and people would just bury them in big mass graves.
Mm.
Yeah. But there's, it's surprising how little you can see about that intercambio, exchange between Guatemala and Chiapas
yeah.
nowadays.
But it seems like there was a lot.
There must have been.
Communities
at that time, yeah.
In Chiapas took in Guatemala. That mm-hmm.
yeah,
yeah. There's still people who may still be.
Yeah.
So in year 2004, the Zapatistas were celebrating 7 years since the uprising, and they took stock of their work so far. They considered the main improvements were in justice, health, and education, because, as we said, these systems, even if they don't have any money income from the government, they are more rooted in the people's way of living. So yeah, education, for example, also considers indigenous languages, and yeah, everything is built from the people and not bringing solutions from Mexico City to educate the indigenous peoples. And also they passed laws against the abuse of natural resources and the traffic of migrants. Mm. Yeah, you can see that communities belonging to other parties like used the wood in the forest in a more commercial or aggressive way than Zapatistas. Zapatistas are very aware about environmental issues. On the other hand, the main drawbacks were the women's participation. Even if women's rights have been a very important part of the Zapatista fight, and it's always very visible in their manifestos, the women's participation in their government had not been very, very strong until 2004. And also there was excessive guidance from the military structure over the civil government.
Can I ask about that, women? Because from the beginning, the Zapatistas were presented as a space that there was a lot more rights and freedom for women.
Uh-huh.
And there's like very famous, Comandante Ramona's, and there's these very famous images that were given, and then from January 1998 with those two little indigenous women pushing the soldier back, and a lot of this useless images to talk about how this is a movement that had a lot more space for women. And then starting in 2004, I started hearing these critiques that, and I've heard them since then from others, that there really is very little female involvement. So I'm wondering if her early assessment was completely wrong.
No, not at all. It wasn't wrong at all.
Like, for instance, we went to Roberto Barrios, which is the Caracol in the northern zone, just 3 weeks ago, and there was not one single woman in the council of good governance, which
Yeah, we were a bit surprised.
So
the women are so stubborn, Roberto. The women testified
exactly.
And
Aventics.
And they were so articulate, so they're clearly leaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then when you visit like the villages, you will find lots of women working like on a grassroots level more, I think.
So is this a reversal?
It takes time.
Did we misunderstand the originals?
No,
I think
it takes time.
Work
no,
to
it
them,
takes
but
time.
At least they are very aware. I mean, they're trying to improve that.
They're trying at least.
All right. So
but
gender
issues.
This is just an issue of awareness that it's not as.
Well, it's that it takes time to change long traditions and long. And
well,
they're really working on it. And it
changed.
Has changed. It's just not changing as fast, you know, because we've already changed that more, but they were way behind.
But at the risk of reducing 2,000 distinct groups into one homogeneous Indian identity, this is one thing that we often see about indigenous cultures in the Americas, is that there is a lot more. And we often see machismo as a European import, and there's people who build these anthropological arguments that machismo didn't exist before.
But think of Europe or the USA. I mean, there's been a long fight for women's rights, but we have never had a woman as a president.
No. That's exactly my point. Is that some people build an argument that that indigenous cultures tend to have more space for tend to be more equal, or sometimes people talk about gender complementarity or duality, and that this whole phenomena of male domination is a European import.
In certain aspects, yes, because if you look at the religion, like if you look at the daikons here, they usually always work in pairs, so there is always the man and the woman working together. And also if you go to religious ceremony, in the community where we'll go to, actually, the Las Abejas community, there are always one of the women is in charge of the incense, like the which is like a very, very symbolical cargo position.
I'm getting a little worried about the time.
Yeah.
Because we're spending so much time on one issue, and we have a lot of things to
summarize.
To do.
The difference is between better and good. Maybe the Zapatistas were doing it better.
Exactly.
There's still ways to go to get it good or equal. You know,
because if you look at the Las Abejas, for instance, they don't have any implementation of this kind. They don't have like any. They don't try to have women in their mesa directiva.
Right.
They're working on it a little bit now, but they still have a long way to go. Whereas the Zapatistas have been like trying to make people aware about this for a rather long time.
One
little thing about the traffic of illegal migrants. What is that about?
Can I say one other thing about the women thing? Okay, but I just wanted to clarify because I think it's really good. I mean, what they've done. That in the juntas, in the higher levels, in the juntas of Buen Gobierno, there are women. I think in all of them, and in some autonomous municipalities, like the one I worked in, Magdalena, there's four women in the autonomous council.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really working on women taking leadership,
yeah.
And they're taking much more leadership than they did before.
Yeah, maybe what you can say is one time in one of the juntas, they said as well to us, like, of course we want much more women participation, but it's taking time, especially for the women themselves, because they're not used to it.
To feel confident.
So I remember one time I came to one of the communities and there was this shy indigenous woman who didn't want to say anything and was just on the board. 3 months later I come back, she was well in a mess, and she was like, well, who are you, what are you going to do, what can we do for you, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's an empowerment that's taking time as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as well for the women who have always more responsibility of the care of the children. And it's another, there is another pause or another step to do to organize that as well, to be able to be in a position like that.
Yeah.
So the thing about the migrants, I'm not too sure about it, but I think it's about some people charge a lot of money to take migrants over the...
Yeah,
they are called coyotes, so I think it's...
So they have
this
a lot.
Coyote issue, it is forbidden.
A lot to not get involved in this kind of stuff.
Okay. This is the parish priest of San Andres. He's a very good friend of ours.
Because Tanya is going to present you.
De California, ¿verdad?
Sí.
Hola. Sí, sí. Sí.
Sí. Sí. Sí.
Sí.
El sacerdote de la iglesia grande.
Sí, sí. De una grande y
muchas pequeñas.
Muchas pequeñas. Sí. Sí. Así estamos.
Okay. So he saw us in Sedesi. That's how we knew who we were.
Yeah, he's in charge for all the municipality, which is really enormous, and with lots of small communities.
What's his name?
Choi.
Oh, I have a photo of somebody else, but to deliver to him.
Jesus is the name. Chuy is like the nickname.
He's a very courageous and brave priest. He's the priest for everybody, right? Not just the Subsatistas, but just the autonomous.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
So Fox was insisting on this idea about the conflict being over. So he said that it's something from the past and that everyone is looking forward. He has been saying this for 6 years, that Zapatistas are something to forget about. At the same time, the ECLN declares a red alert as a preventive measure to hold an internal consultation. It was clear that it was going to be something very important. They were holding internal consultations that finally led to the 6th declaration of the La Cantona Jungle. This declaration is a proposal, a call to build a new national anti-capitalist front, like a new way to make politics. As they had said that there was nothing to do with the traditional electoral system and the official parties, they tried to build something new. And for this, they want to come together with all the left-wing and anti-capitalist groups in the country, not only in Chiapas.
What was that?
2006 was the year of the campaigns because we had elections in Chiapas, in Mexico, and we also had the other campaign. The presidential elections were a big mess. On the night of the elections, nobody knew who had won. Both candidates, Felipe Calderón, the right-wing candidate for PAN, and López Obrador, the left-wing candidate for PRD, declared themselves the winners. So for months there was a big fight to know who had won. The court declared Calderón the official winner, but López Obrador still calls himself the legitimate president. And for a few months there were enormous demonstrations in Mexico City. There were also like a kind of camps on the main streets and squares. So the city was blocked for a few months. Finally, they took off the camps. Another big conflict was in Oaxaca, where there was a protest from the teachers' union. It was repressed in a very, very violent way. So many people came together with the protest, with the teachers, and created the APO, the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca. What can I say? That? You know what I'm doing.
Every day.
You know about
every day.
You know
about the. Well, but not three of us. So.
Yeah, it was kind of many, many left wingers. I can make a small summary. It was how many? Like 200. Almost 300 organizations, left-wing and social organizations, coming together and creating a kind of government that occupied the city of Oaxaca for a few months, demanding the resignation of the state governor, who is a massive human rights violator.
And was totally connected with the PRI. The PRI has like this stranglehold on Oaxaca.
Yeah.
How was APCO viewed from here in Chiapas?
The public opinion in Mexico is like really hard to measure. The social and left-wing organizations supported APCO completely. They actually admired this movement.
Including the Zapatistas.
Yeah. There was a long silence of doubt, and many people were asking themselves why Marcos was not supporting APO, mm-hmm. and finally he supported them, and the reason he said was that he didn't want to state this supposed link between the Zapatistas and the APO, because this way the government could say that APO was also a guerrilla,
mm-hmm.
and they could repress them harder. But there are more things going on there, because the teachers union is a big part of APO, and the teachers union does not like Marcos so much.
That's not true. I mean, maybe the leadership, but the rank and file that we met, some of them were part of the other campaign.
It's really mixed. Quick question about the other campaign. Was the purpose of the other campaign to meet with leftist groups in Mexico?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And indigenous groups.
Go check Twitter.
From the book.
Did you read the Sixth Declaration?
I didn't have the patience to read it.
You don't have to go. You've got a little summarized Richard.
That's
the Apple campaign doing the new
right. No, the other campaign is not about the Apple.
No.
It's about what the Zapatistas came out with in 2005, after they declared the red alert, and it's to build an alternative politics in Mexico and internationally. So this intergalactic meeting is about to plan the international working together.
Mm-hmm.
But it really includes indigenous peoples, not just left groups, you know.
Yeah, the ultimate goal will be to create a new country that will not marginalize indigenous peoples,
mm-hmm.
workers, students, women, sexual minorities. And another big conflict was in Atenco, where some people were, it was a kind of festival, some people were trying to sell their flowers in the street, but they didn't have an official permission for that. So they were severely repressed by the police. Again, the people came together with the protest. There was a bigger repression, and two people were killed. I think at least one of them was younger than 18 years old.
He was, I think, 14.
And many people, many something like 200 or 300 people were arrested, and many women were raped in the.
Mm-hmm.
On the way from the place of the detention to the prison.
Five people were expelled from Mexico, and the people who were like captured and put into the detention afterwards, they were condemned to
67 years.
Or even more, no?
67.
Oh, 67, yeah. I thought,
well, the prosecutor was already asking for a higher punishment.
And they were leaders of the incredible successful movement in San Salvador Atenco against the airport in 2001. So the government wanted to get back at them.
Yeah. And no policemen have been captured.
What was the reason for the repression of Atenco?
It has a long story, because before there were plans, a few years ago there were plans to build an airport there.
Oh.
And the people wanted to remain as campesinos, like working their land.
Mm-hmm.
So they canceled these plans to build the airport. And now it was something about
Walmart.
Yeah, a Walmart supermarket
Walmart.
Was going to be built.
Yeah.
I've heard a critique that strategically Atenco was a mistake because it distracted a national campaign until it was essentially a relatively minor local issue. Do you think that's a fair critique?
Critique of who?
The other campaign.
I think I cannot answer that.
But the other campaign didn't do Atenco. Atenco happened, and the other campaign supported them.
Well,
yeah.
It happened
just
like
happened
a few days after Marcos passed.
Yeah, but I mean, the other campaign, Marcos didn't have anything to do with it. It was the police.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the thing about the APO and the protesters in Atenco obviously you cannot make a comparison because the violence coming from the police is much higher, mm-hmm. but they are not totally peaceful protesters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
they don't have, I mean, they are not shooting guns or anything, but yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, some policemen were injured in this protest.
And ACLO in Oaxaca is definitely not a very peaceful organization, or at least they have like...
It is.
Organization.
That's what they try to make you think. Yeah.
I mean, they're not a terrorist group.
Sure, there's a few young people that want to go off and do that, but the ACLO itself is very... It's always trying to stop people from doing that. I mean, that's what everybody was telling us. We talked to many people from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're really seated in nonviolence.
I'm not. I'm not so.
Did
I mean, it's very hard to distinguish what is ACLO and what is not.
Yeah.
But some people very strongly inside ACLO, especially young, quite radical groups like anarchists and so on. I mean, they are not violent like in a terrorist way. They won't go and kill anyone. But they consider themselves. They consider they have the right to defend themselves from the police. So if the police comes and attack, they won't like go away. They will resist and try to fight back. I mean, not peacefully in this way. Not. I don't mean that they go and attack or kill anyone.
They won't instigate violence, but they'll repel violence with violence.
Yeah.
Sure. So at least some people inside ACLO.
Yeah, but basically it's a peaceful movement, is what everybody was telling us. I mean,
but they, like yesterday, they put themselves, you know, when they went up to the 14th, that's a risky situation. It's like they were going to cause violence necessarily, but the risk was that there would be violence because they were at least, so in a way, they inflame the possibility of conflict. Now,
you don't even know what happened yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
It's a very polarized situation.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
But they're trying to make people think. So small a part of it is that. And there's so many instigators inside that are really government instigators, and that's what they want everybody to believe. Is, you know, and so even the left believes it. You know, and they're making sure there's some people in there, but the basic movement is a nonviolent movement.
I don't know.
Have you been talking to them?
I know a couple of people who know people in the ACLO, and I can tell you they're not very peaceful as such. But
the people that they know.
Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know how big they are.
It's huge.
Yeah. Yeah, ACLO is
huge.
Huge.
I mean, you can't. There are individuals.
Sure. There's
indigenous
communities,
yeah.
And there's NGOs. And
but my original question of whether it was a mistake to suspend the other campaign to focus on a thinker, you said that's too dicey of a question to address.
I don't really have an answer. I mean,
yeah, me neither.
But I have an answer. There was this terrible repression going on, and of course they were members of the other campaign, and they needed to support them. I mean, they're not going to just let all this horrible stuff happen and people be killed and not say anything. They really needed to accompany them. The police did this horrible oppression in Atenco. The people of Atenco were members of the other campaign.
Yes.
And so the Zapatistas, who had started the other campaign, of course, needed to support them.
Right. So people were involved in. It wasn't as if the Atenco issue with the flowers and all that was totally separate. I mean,
that's
still not.
So
it's not
what?
Don't
worry about it. Can we get back to history?
Yeah.
Stop.
It's
talking about
actually, it's
we're done.
Yeah,
okay.
We still miss like 2007, but we don't have any PowerPoint.
That's okay. That's what we're going to experience.
So we're actually thinking about what can we like tell people about 2007 because things are like we still don't know where the things are heading. It's like. Everybody's waiting to see what's going to happen. The other campaign entered its second round, so Marcos and 14 commanders are in the north, or actually they're in Mexico City right now, and they're like visiting all the states again, and once again listening and talking to people there. And here in Chiapas, well, there have been a few conflicts mostly related to the agricultural situation,
yeah.
But also, like for instance, Pedro Chulín has been put in detention, and Chulín is one of the leaders behind a paramilitary group in the 90s, but also is supposed to be the intellectual leader behind a new organization called OPDIC, which you will
yeah.
get to know
mm-hmm.
more.
Yeah, let me
say. I saw that.
Heard a lot about that, but some
yeah.
people may not have.
Yeah, but you will. We'll talk about OPDIC tomorrow, I think.
I did send you guys a. I
so
sent
he
you
was
all
the
something
one
about
was
OPDIC.
He was previously the leader of Paz Justicia
yeah.
and OPDIC, same guy.
Chulín, no. He was leader of Chinchulines.
Ah.
For instance, but also Mira.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I don't know if we should take the PowerPoint presentation about CIPAS, or
no,
do you want to tell about CIPAS in these days, the following couple of days? I don't know.
How's the time?
It's 5:30.
I think maybe we shouldn't do another PowerPoint.
No, yeah. It's mainly pictures and things. But yeah,
mm-hmm.
sure.
Can you just give us your
just give us a little
sort of
your mission?
Your yeah.
What's your mission?
Brief thing.
Well, we can do like a 5-minute presentation
yeah.
of CIPAS.
Yeah.
I think that's at least like
yeah.
you have an idea with whom you're gonna travel these days.
Yeah, we need to do that.
That might be. CIPAS is the response of the international community after the Zapatista uprising. There came a delegation down to Rio. Meanwhile, you can show some pictures of
yeah, I'm
the PowerPoint.
I don't know how to do this.
And so CIPAS started in 95 as an international organization on the response of the civil society, the local civil society, because there was really clear a need for a lot of people were coming in those delegations and missions, but again the question from the local civil society, well, it's nice that you come, but it would be better if you stayed, and an intent of about 10, 11 organizations that were in the beginning, in that first delegation decided to start a coalition. In the beginning, it was only 10 organizations that formed together CIPAS and were looking like to send down. None of those organizations were mainly from the US and all faith-based or active nonviolent.
You have that list in the first page. Yeah.
And this coalition grew up to a list of about 50.
Idea.
Yeah. of 50 organizations with a permanent team here in San Cristobal. You can say we have three areas of work. I'm going to go a little fast to the three areas of work. One is one is international presence and accompaniment. That means
popular.
Sorry.
Popular
today. When is that? No se fue a la casa. Sale. But all here. So part is like with the international presence to have a dissuasive force and to prevent situations of violence, information, and so the three areas are international presence and observation, information, and peace education. We, the Northern Zone is one of the areas where we work. Semi-permanent since 96, and in for instance, other organizations sometimes have like all the time people in the same places. We only visit those villages like every 3 months and see what's going on.
Unbelievable.
Well, that's now.
Yeah. 1 year ago, yes.
This is the highlands here.
It's a demonstration against the presence of a military base.
Mm-hmm. In the Northern Zone.
So quite often it is our presence that we try to prevent more violence just by being there and being like the international eyes and witnesses of what's going on.
Yes.
are some examples.
Those were displaced people getting back to their communities.
Turkey and Afghanistan. And these are other missions we've been assisting in.
They're where they left. The meetings for the other campaign.
So are you participating in the other campaign?
As observers.
Adherentes?
Only observers.
Oh, observers.
Yeah.
Especially the discussion has been because it's a national campaign and we're an international organization.
Yes.
So the initial idea was as an international organization, it's not our role to be active in a national program.
Mm-hmm.
As well as a result of this, there was a lot of human rights violations and intimidation and attacks to activists and human rights activists here in San Cristobal, about 20 cases over the last year. Even we received intimidation. So at that time, it was time to take a pass backwards and not be like.
Yeah, but did you go on the campaign management? Did any of you go?
Yes, we went to Guerrero, we went to Oaxaca, we were also present here in Chiapas and in Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in Guerrero, you were in
Oaxaca.
Okay. Marina and Roberto were in Mexico City.
I was not in Cipad yet.
Oh, okay.
Did you say you were in Guerrero?
No, Guerrero.
Guerrero.
Because since 2005, CIPAS has expanded its work to include also Guerrero and Oaxaca. Before we were mainly working in Chiapas, but now we're also visiting Guerrero and Oaxaca and writing about these two states because we find that the problems in these two states are so similar to the problems in Chiapas.
Yeah. And then the two other states with the highest indigenous population.
Exactly. So these are some visits we made. Wow, lots of them. This is Rodolfo Stanlagen, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and we accompanied his visit to Guerrero last year. And this is in Oaxaca.
This is an occupied county seat in Oaxaca.
This is when John and Roberto participated in the civil observation mission last year.
What part of Oaxaca were you in?
The mission was mainly in the city, but also in some some municipalities close to the city. Because the conflict is more present in the city than in the communities.
Uh-huh.
There are areas of Oaxaca where people hardly know anything about Tarpo,
right,
or about the conflict.
This is our second
work field
information and lobbying and it's given information about the causes and consequences of the conflict to local actors and to the international community.
Yeah.
And that's when went to the USA.
Yeah.
So true, they finally closed it. No, they didn't go too close.
They just
lost by 1 vote.
And also, we organized and received delegations, mainly from the U.S., students, religious groups, and journalists.
What kind of religious groups?
Yeah.
What kind?
Most of them are can be like a lot of our
coalition
members.
Right.
That is, can be sometimes Pastors for Peace or other organizations that come across. It can be like that we coordinate a whole delegation. It can be we can coordinate a part of a delegation. It can be that we give only a presentation about our work and the development of the conflict. There's like a whole variety of things. And some groups, for instance, ask, especially my ministries, ask sometimes of more workshop, more like conflict transformation workshops or those kind of things. So it can be really, can be a whole scala of things that people come by and ask us to do.
but also
thank
like
you.
Solidarity tourists who come to Chiapas and mm-hmm. knock on the door, because we're also on the lonely planet. I didn't know about that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
So.
Is CIPA part of a greater international organization?
No. Well, it's a coalition of a lot of organizations, but CIPAS in itself is only here. It's not that there's also CIPAS in
Colombia.
Well, we
participate in the Chiapas Peace Network, also in the Mexican Peace Network, and in the Latin American Peace Network.
Mm-hmm. I wondered if there was a network of observation groups like yourself that you participated with others in other parts of the world. Like
It's not very active now, but...
Yeah, and of course with the other organizations that do here in Mexico Observation Group, we have a close relationship, for instance PBI, Peace Brigades International, or Witness for Peace,
yeah.
or some other organization, Brazilian Peacemaker teams have left here. But I think every organization has its own statement and its own liberty
mm-hmm.
on how to move. For instance
mm-hmm.
PBI will never be able to go to a Zapatista community because they're not allowed. Although it's a civil, the Council of Good Governance is a civil organization, they're, in their statement, for instance, they will never talk with armed groups. Where in CIPAS we have the philosophy to talk with all actors involved in the conflict. So that there are like differences in how you treat to get like a peace process going on, what is different between different organizations.
Right.
In that sense, there is a close, we know all about each other, what we do and what we think, but sometimes we have different visions
sure.
on how to...
Is that true? Christian peacemaker teams too?
Christian peacemaker teams left, I think, in 2000. It was before I came.
Oh, okay.
But they were much more from active nonviolent action. So they were praying in front of a military base
mm-hmm.
and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We also occasionally raise urgent actions, and this was regarding to Felipe Arriaga, who's a prisoner of conscience from Guerrero, who was liberated in 2005. Also contacting lobbying different politicians and representatives.
In the U.S. or here?
Well, it's on all levels.
Huh?
No, there's the CIPAS. Everybody wants the CIPAS.
Yeah.
Inform me.
The lobbying work is
I promise we didn't force them to do it.
Would you like one, Walter?
Okay.
I got one in Spanish.
Yeah, oh, you got one. Okay,
yeah.
That's in Spanish.
Really highly recommend their publication. It's an excellent publication and has been so for
okay.
many years. Yeah.
That's pretty. And also,
mm-hmm.
like in the northern zone where information doesn't reach the people, our newsletters are fairly well received.
How do you distribute it here, but like that by hand?
We go to Caracoles and we distribute it there, but also when we go to the northern zone, we distribute it there, or to organizations here in San Cristobal who have contacts in the villages.
And it's the same thing you sent to us in English in
yeah.
the States? It's
yeah.
exactly the same.
Yeah.
I'd really, tomorrow maybe, we're on the road, I'd really like to hear a little bit more about your work in the northern zone, because you hear so little about the northern zone,
exactly.
and you guys are kind of like the only ones that really
John and
know
I were
about
there.
It. I mean, it's like this little... no man's land sort of thing.
It is. We were there a week ago, and we asked people, like, are there any people coming to visit you nowadays? No, you're the only ones who come here.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, for you.
Yeah, because
it's been here for a long time.
Yeah.
Pretty much. It's been a long time.
And this is our third area. Thank you.
Axis of
Blood. Yes. And this was, this is peace education, workshops on conflict transformation and nonviolence. This is a project we had, a couple of years ago, with puppets regarding value of diversity and reconciliation.
which was very very beloved in the community. People often ask us about it still. And also religious, inter-religious dialogue, which is a form of bringing people together. And this is a Mayan altar or a cross. And that's Marina. Networking.
They did a whole thing a few years ago. They did a whole workshop that went all around the country that had to do with Gandhi and talking to people about who Gandhi was and what he did and what he believed. It was really interesting how you managed to do that.
Well,
introduced Gandhi to indigenous people.
I don't know that about that. This is a forum that was organized by my old organization, SWEFOR, in Colombia, where I yet attended. This is where Marina went to the World Social Forum in Venezuela last year. And this is our board, which is...
There's a meeting of the board every year here in the office.
And the board is from one country, or?
The US,
Ecuador,
Costa Rica,
Sweden. This is the old team from 2005. Elena is now in Guerrero, and Lola is in Spain. And this is the new team.
Roberto is just here.
Okay. Oh, thank you, that was...
That is a good card. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
A lot of this come out of more of an advocacy solidarity type framework where we simplistically maybe see the world in terms of good and evil. What way are we want to ally ourselves?
Pay for yourself.
I mean that is a simplistic class, but where we ally, where all things aren't equal. That we do see things that are right and wrong, and that seems to run a bit counter to see process work, right? In terms of like dialogue in between different groups.
Trying to reach like integral solutions to the conflict because it's so complex.
Because I think for some of us, getting peace is easy if you're willing to be massacred. But for
what?
I don't know if this makes sense
to
you,
peace?
But for me at least, I'll speak just for myself, justice is more important, and so often justice means taking sides.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel that tension in your work, you end up dialoguing with, for me it would be hard to dialogue with the paramilitaries and see them as an equal actor, because I disagree with what you're doing, and I think you're wrong.
But if you see them as like a co-opted part of the... of the society, which does not really, I mean, they did not opt by ideological, with an ideological or...
They're being used for, they're pawns in this game with the government.
That
so then
doesn't
is the government evil? That's the question.
Yeah.
Bad government.
Yeah, that's what they talk about here. But that doesn't mean that you should take away, like, the individual responsibility of people either, because, I don't know, a paramilitary soldier... has opted for this, and I think that's important as well. But I mean, people here live in poverty or extreme poverty, and
poverty or extreme.
Yeah, and that means that they are easily manipulated. If the government issues a project or something, or if they give them money through a church or anything, and they try to make, and I mean, they don't say that this is. What you have to do now is something bad. They can trick them into it by saying that it's good.
But talking to them doesn't mean we see them like equal actors.
Right. Yeah.
We don't equalize like victims and paramilitary groups, of course.
But that doesn't mean that we don't, I mean, we see that the Zapatistas have a very good project, and they have very good solutions to certain things, but they have done things in the past that are not that clear as well.
Yeah.
And we're not trying to see everything as black and white, but giving it a little bit of, I don't know.
I think the contact with the people in the communities gives you this more complex views.
A lot of groups have pulled out of Chiapas. Do you see you guys staying here long term or going into Guerrero and Oaxaca? Is that like you're trying transforming the mission of CFAS?
I see that as a bit problematic. I don't know if CFAS should like go so much in deep and Guerrero and Oaxaca. I think we should focus more here in Chiapas. But I don't know, we still haven't.
Well, what we said, starting to inform about Oaxaca and Guerrero from 2004-05 on, was like the causes that made the conflict or the uprising here are more or less the same you will see in Oaxaca and Guerrero. So what you see is there's this poverty or extreme poverty, marginalization, militarization, all those causes that made that there wasn't an uprising here. As like, and as well, CFAS, you can see it, we see it more like as a window, like through our window, through our website, we can show people that the conflict is not only here in Chiapas, although right now you may say it has changed with the whole APO and things that came up. But it was like it's not the idea that we could have moving the office to another part. But of course, it's true that after the 11th of September, it's even harder all the time to get like financed a project like this because a lot of international attention is going to another part of the world, and I think that's one of the difficult things you have to realize as well, that there is an international view, and Chiapas is not like in the middle of that view, although there is a lot of solidarity to Chiapas, international solidarity to Chiapas, but it's also quite often. Especially after the creations of the Caracoles, there is much more direct interaction with the Zapatistas. So there is also a possibility for a lot of people to have this direct interaction with the Zapatistas. So people who come, you right now, you will see like there are different kinds of international solidarity. And that's also something that I think it's developing.
Sure.
And I think as an organization, as CFAS, you cannot say, well, we're not going to stop this year, but I'm not sure if we're here still in 5 or 7 years. You have to see as well what's going on.
If you ask Padre Chuy about the situation here in Chiapas, he will tell you that there is war here. That's his expression. He says, there is war in my community, in my municipality. But of course, if you say that to people who are paying to resolve conflicts, they will look at Afghanistan or Iraq and they will say, well, there are 70 people killed there every day. Obviously, we don't have persons being killed every day here, but there is still so much tension, so much insecurity here, so, yeah.
I think one big thing, and maybe we're saving it till tomorrow, unless Yet's going to talk about it today, but the whole issue, one of the things that I really want to learn about is the land conflicts and the current attempts by the government and
OT
to get the Zapatistas off the land.
I think Olga Isabel will be like a very good
example
for you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Should we go to the logistic?
Yes.
I think I'm not really sure how much you know already about the program, but I'm going over it, and there's a few things I want to talk about.
We have an itinerary.
Uh-huh.
Everybody got.
Okay, so you know more or less what idea is tomorrow. We will leave at 9, so. The bus will stop at the address you gave me in Josefa Ortiz Domingos.
We're all there.
34A.
Yeah.
I will be there as well. Probably I will be a half an hour before.
34A.
34. Well, that's the address I got. I don't know. Although the other way, the bus will be like 2 houses away.
Yes,
thanks,
so. Sorry. And you'll be there at 8:30.
I will be there at 8:30. Probably the driver will be there as well. I just talked to the Julio, who is working in Capisa, who is organizing the transport for us. We will have the same driver for the 4 days. I didn't organize it, but I'm going to talk with you later on for the last day, because I think I was like not that clear how many people, and we can see, but I think we can organize still something if you want. So that's the thing. Then we go into Morelia. I went there last Tuesday to ask if I could get the permission at once. They wanted us to present ourselves there, who we are, and things like that. That's most of the time the way it works. And I think it's also nice because you will see, because you will only be in the event in Oventic, you will see all the preparations they are making for the
And also
event.
We'll need to go to the Buen Gobierno, which we won't get to do in Oventic, because I'm sure they won't be meeting with anybody. There will be so many people there.
And as well, what I've asked them in the card, that they will tell us as well a little bit about the problem of Olga Isabel, what's going on there, so that they can tell us as well a little bit what's going on. I'm not really sure if they're able because of the meeting. So they're really very busy with preparing the things, but probably someone will be able to talk to us for a little while. And then we go on to Olga Isabel and see if we can talk there with the representative. There's always in those kind of, how to say, there's a lot of things that's not that sure. So you should be aware that it might be that there are like 20 people before us when we arrive. And that means that we have to wait these 20 people, because it's the first one who comes will be attended first by the Council of Good Government. So there's a lot of things I cannot plan beforehand, and we have to be a little flexible in that sense and prepare ourselves for different situations, because it can be that we have to stay quite long and only can go like on the 19th to Olga Isabel. There can be different things, and I cannot tell you. I've done what I could do, but it's always, there are some things unforeseen, and that's a little bit the way it is. But the idea is that if we're there by 10:30 more or less, that will be for them 9:30, because the people in the communities. Yeah, they don't change to summertime. Daylight saving time.
We really discovered this in Oaxaca.
Okay, so that's always something. I've made a reservation for 4 hotel rooms in Chilon, what's really nearby Olga Isabel. And the thing is, I have a list with things to bring, but of course, it's only for the ones who's gonna stay in the community. And I just want to check, is that okay if there are like 8, it's our 4 double rooms, if that's enough, or are there more people who
there would be 8 people, but we're only 10 people. And then there's you.
We're only 10, you're only 10, I thought you were 11.
Well, the other person asked if she could come, and then she didn't come.
Oh, she didn't come. Okay.
Can I just clarify, is the choice that we can stay in the community or stay in the hotel? I see, and would the community give us a place to sleep if we have a sleeping bag or something?
Yeah, but you have to, you probably will sleep or on the mat floor, or will not be like a bed or something. It's like quite primitive situation. Probably there are no toilets, but it's like a latrina. It's like just a hole in the ground, those kind of things. But of course, it's a really wonderful experience. If you're physically like able to do it, I would say it's really nice to do it. But if you feel like, well, if it's raining and I don't feel like it. But we can see it also on the way, probably there are more rooms available in the hotel, and just see if you're there, what you want to do. But it can be as well that the Junta, the Council of Good Governance, is going to ask us how many people want to stay in the community, which people. So think about it, and tomorrow morning I come back to you, and then we can see how we organize that part.
Would you need to have our own bedding if we stay in the community?
Yeah. So you need a sleeping bag.
But it's hot, right? You don't actually need a sleeping bag. You need something to cover you.
You need something to cover you.
Too hot with the sleeping bag. No. At least I have been with.
Well, you were going to give a list of things that you thought we should bring.
Yeah, but it's, of course, it's like the basic things. And it is like, if you're going to stay in the community, well, a change of clothes, a rain jacket or poncho or umbrella is very important, and some boots. Bring water, bring a bottle of water. I'm not sure in Olga Isabel. Tanya, hay un río allá para bañar? En Olga, hay un río allá para bañar?
Pero es un poco,
poco lejos. Well, probably if we kind of go back the next day, we don't need two.
There are like showers. There's one shower.
There's one shower. So, but it's like a towel, bio, what do you call it? Some soap, things like that, a flashlight, your own personal hygiene project, insect repellent, toilet paper, a hat and sunblock, a flashlight and batteries, a water bottle, a small plastic bag. Maybe we can bring also some bags to put the garbage in so that we don't leave our garbage in the community.
What about food?
That's something we have to see as well. Well, I go over my list and then we go back to the food.
Some of those things are good for people who aren't staying in the community.
Exactly, I think most
insect spray, a hat.
I think I'm just gonna go over this too. And as well, it's like most of we can share also some projects. It's not that we all, but your toothbrush and things like that. Your personal hygiene products, those kind of things. Just prepare yourself. You're gonna sleep one night somewhere, and if you don't have like sleeping bags and things like that, we can see how many we have here. But if it's only like 10 or 11 person or 12 persons that are gonna go, we can see. But I think the ones who are able to have a night in a community, it's a wonderful experience to have it, and we can see how we organize it. But I think the ones we have some sleeping bags here. So if you want, I don't know if you are carrying a sleeping bag with you or not. If
well,
you
some of us are. But my question about Olga Isabel, I've never been there, and I don't know what, like we went to La Culebra and there was no way you'd need a sleeping bag, it's too hot.
That's further down.
But and you go to Oventique, and yes, you need a sleeping bag, or Magdalena, or any of the places in the hospital.
And you're just in between.
Okay, so
you're just in between. Mm-hmm. So if it's not raining, and it has not been raining there for 5 days, it might be warm enough, but it's gonna get cold by 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And if it's raining, it's like the temperature drops like some degrees, and you will.
And they give you some cover. To where you sleep in the community, they give you a place inside or you're outside.
Yeah. There's most of the time in the house of the campamentistas or another place. They're like an auditorium, so you're inside
you're
a building.
Covered. Okay.
You're covered.
No, there are lots of houses. I don't think there is place in the car.
Yeah, there is.
Oh, there is.
There is because there's 10. But so maybe Tanya is gonna come with us as well. Tanya has been a campamentista and Olga Isabel for a long time, but we will talk it over and you will see her showing up tomorrow or not. That will be a surprise. So that's the question is as well, like bring some long sleeve shirts or a sweater, because if it's gonna rain and it's not gonna get that cold as it's here, but because we're going much more down, but it's gonna get a little cold.
So maybe we should ask now who wants to sleep in the community and who might need a sleeping bag. So if you come tomorrow, you would bring.
So, are there people already people who would?
I have a sleeping bag.
Okay.
Me too, and I have one.
Check for me.
I don't have a sleeping bag.
So we check a sleeping bag for you right now. After this.
Anybody else?
Carol. And then maybe coming back.
Carol, maybe.
Okay, I'll try it. Good for you, Carol.
I've been there, done that too. But I can go either way.
So we will look for two sleeping bags for you.
And if you only have one, for you.
I have one question. The one thing I don't like about sleeping in communities, but I was going to ask her because she's stayed there, is I tend to come home with fleas, and then I have to deal with them for a long time. And I'm just wondering if this is a the case there. It's not going to be, right?
You never know. You never know. Yeah. It can be.
But I've gotten them actually when I haven't slept there. I've just been hanging around. Yeah.
You can get them. And insect repellent will not work, so.
Oh, no.
There's no.
What does insect repellent help you for?
Mosquitoes.
Oh, mosquitoes.
Do we have to bring an identification
with us? Yeah, that's what I'm going to come on right now. You have to bring your passport with you, with the migration paper. And that's one of the things I want to say as well. I saw that some of you had this nice little identification card. Not to put it on in the car, because if we got stuck by a roadblock and the military, we passed by one, surely. It's always the thing we ask not to put on like very expressive t-shirts or things like that, because it can give some problems. Most of the time you're tourists, so we try to act like tourists. If they stop us, probably the best thing is to do, if you don't speak any Spanish at all, probably the driver will say that we're going to Palenque, and those kind of things. It has changed a lot over the last few years, but sometimes they stop you. There's one by Temo, and they stopped Tanya last week. So that's something that is, it's something. So don't say what you're doing and things like that. It's act like a tourist and be like a tourist.
And it's pretty ground rule. Not photograph police, right? That is not.
And for instance, as well, in the autonomous communities, you're not allowed to take any photographs unless you ask a permission.
You can ask permission.
You can ask permission, and then most of the time they will say only from the paintings on the wall, not from the people, or the people have to put on their ski mask or their paliacate.
Is it better appropriate for you to ask for us when we enter the community and see what permissions they will give to us?
We will ask at the junta, at the council, to if we can are able to take photographs. Probably in Morelia we're not able. Probably in Olga Isabel people have to put on their.
But also like in Oventique, they're always wearing their masks. The junta is usually wearing their masks anyway, and so that when we ask, they're glad to.
Well, in Morelia, normally they don't put on their. So if you want to take pictures, they will put on their.
So we will wait to hear from you before we can take.
Yeah, and if I forget, just remind me about the picture thing.
I wasn't aware. I know I gave you a passport number, but I didn't bring my passport. I brought the front page of it. Is that enough?
No, you need your passport.
Then I can't go.
Well, just go.
Who and be the
just go
and bring the page.
Bring the page, but
okay. You don't have
in Mexico, legally you have to carry your passport with you if you're traveling.
So.
Yeah.
In Mexico, yeah. It's probably not a problem, San Miguel, because there's not a conflict situation. But if you're somewhere where there is.
Who will ask? The ministry?
Yeah. Or migration. But
is there a place to get mosquito nets in town?
Probably not in San Cristobal since we don't have any mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a place to buy
No,
but we can try to scare up things. That's easy. Ponchos are easy to buy.
Okay, but I looked today and I couldn't find what I was.
If it's pouring, people will suddenly appear selling them.
Yes.
I did two yesterday. Well, no, I one got messed up with a tamale when there was a scare.
But that was it. We can sort this out amongst ourselves in terms of what we need.
But that was like the photographs and the passport is like a thing. One time I was in a group and we got stopped 3 times by the migration, and it was also one person who only had the birth certificate with her, and I said to her, well, show it the last one. Like, if there are other people with passports, they don't kind of check us all. It's like just to see some, so. It's like, don't, if there are the other ones with a passport, and if they kind of ask them all, but you have a
I have
an
FM3 visit home too.
Okay,
but you have a copy of your passport.
I have the first page of my passport,
which is with your picture in it.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you can say you leave it in your at your.
A couple of weeks ago, one of the members of SIEPAC, I think you're going to SIEPAC afterwards. Mm-hmm. He was stopped in the checkpoint, and they asked him, "Who are you?" And he said, "Oh, I'm a great, I'm a high European commissioner." And he showed them his driver's license. They looked at him. They let him pass.
So but who was this?
He's just an Italian volunteer.
He's an Italian volunteer.
He's not an IRP.
So don't be too much too. But sometimes it can be like with an event going on.
Exactly.
I don't think that they're gonna check us, but it might be, and be aware of it. You cannot change it anyway, and if they want to do something,
you will pass a checkpoint. That's for sure. But we don't know if they will stop
up the group if that's something like that.
What's interesting is today when we registered for the event here, they didn't ask for documentation.
But that's here's opportunity.
Sometimes when you go to those events,
they
take your passport. I tried to leave one of those events at 4 in the morning. And they had locked my passport away, and I had to come back later and get it.
But do you have another identification with you?
You have another legal identification?
I have a picture
driver's
license.
Okay.
Say
no,
your
I have
official
a bank card. With your picture?
Yeah.
No, don't worry too much about
it. I know,
it's
stupid.
Then there's the thing about food, because I think if we go to Olga Isabel as well, it's nice to bring some food. But what we can do is...
they usually don't give you food there.
You have to cook yourself.
You have to cook yourself.
Or what we can do is all people go to Chilon, we go there to a restaurant, and the ones who are going to sleep in a community go back to the community.
Then that makes sense.
Well, they have to.
Just to be going back and forth, right?
But it's like
it makes sense to go back to the community if we're
but the ones
going
who
to
sleep. The ones who are going to sleep in the community go back to the community,
mm-hmm.
and that we all go to have dinner,
right.
And we will see if we can have like lunch somewhere on the way between
Morelia
and Chilon.
Okay.
That's because we don't know the time. We have no idea where we are by the time that we get hungry. But I think it would be nice if everyone or we coordinate in a certain way to have some snacks, some energy bars or things or trail mix or whatever with us to have if we have just in case and to go to the